just, we were about to talk about the visit of Henry Kissinger to Pekin, which took place in late April of 1979. He came on the Wednesday, the 25th of April, and I did not go to the airport to meet him, nor did anyone else from the embassy. The reason we did this was that I had seen the exchanges between the Consulate General in Hong Kong and Dr. Kissinger, in which they had offered their services, etc., and got a very curt response that this was a private visit and he wanted nothing to do with that sort of thing. So I took him at his word and made it very private when he came to Pekin. That night, Wang Hua gave a dinner for him in the Great Hall, to which, of course, I was invited. Then, 2 days later, on Friday the 27th, Joe Kraft was in Dr. Kissinger's party. He came out by prearrangement to the embassy to meet with State Roy, the deputy, and myself. When he got there, he said, could he talk to me alone? And I said, of course. He starts out by saying, is Henry Kissinger an American citizen? Well, I said, what brings such a question? Well, the way he's been treated, nobody at the airport to greet him. And so I explained to him why there was no one at the airport to meet him. I explained further to him that Nancy Kissinger, his wife, had been in Pekin the week before, and we had entertained her at lunch with her small group from Vogue, and she was going back to Tokyo to come directly from Tokyo. Anyway, she was coming back in to China with Henry Kissinger. And she had said absolutely nothing, and I had seen her on 3 occasions during her few days' visit. Well, that seemed to satisfy Joe Kraft. He didn't pursue the matter, and he wrote absolutely nothing on it that I was aware of. Then that same night, the 27th, Deng Xiaoping gave a small dinner.
Do you think he had been put up to that by Kissinger?
Oh, I think so. Well, it could have been on his own. But I'm sure they had talked about it, and Kissinger had expressed his unhappiness, I'm certain. So that night, Deng Xiaoping gave a small dinner for Kissinger in the Great Hall. There were just 2 or 3 tables is all. And the Vice Premier sat between the 2 of us. And just before dinner, Dr. Kissinger had invited me to come out to the guest house so that he could fill me in on the details of his conversations, all of which, of course, were without the representation from the embassy, which was not unusual for those who came on such visits. So he was all cordiality at the dinner.
Was Winston with you, with him, when he briefed you?
No, I'll come to that. No, it was just the 2 of us. I was a little upset at the dinner, his talking to me across Deng Xiaoping about the events surrounding the preparation of the Shanghai communique and the inanities of the State Department and of the bureaucrats of the State Department. And how they had to be babied all the time, and how this had all been worked out. But of course, state had not been involved. And then they got in, and in order to justify their existence, made all sorts of stupid presentations, spending hours arguing about all Chinese on both sides of the Taiwan Strait, etc. How did we know that all Chinese on both sides of the strait? What made me upset me was that it seems to me you don't talk about such things of your own government before the leadership of another government, particularly one with which we had such a tenuous relationship for so many years.
Kissinger's memoirs, rather his memcons, are replete with such discussions with Zhou Enlai, you will remember. He spoke ill of many Americans to the Chinese.
I remember that very well, but it's one thing to read it, it's another thing to sit there and listen to it.
Because it struck President Carter immediately when we sent our first Kissinger memcons to Carter. We said that our judgment was that Brzezinski felt the same way, that these were really brilliant discussions of world affairs, and Carter said he didn't think they were brilliant at all, and what caused him particularly to despise Kissinger, to use that word in its classical sense of looking down on history, was the way he spoke of other Americans of the State Department. When Vance and Brzezinski, therefore, went to China, one of Kissinger's main injunctions was, do not do what Kissinger did.
Right. He said the same thing to me, if you remember.
That's right.
Before I went in the first place.
That's right.
Do not, I don't think he used the word kowtow, but that was the gist of his of his instruction to me. But at the dinner, which was quite informal, Deng, of course, as the host, gave a toast. Kissinger responded. And maybe thinking about my little discussion with Joe Kraft a few hours earlier, I gave a toast. I made a twin toast to the architects of what had happened, namely two of the prime architects of what had happened, Vice Premier Deng Xiaoping and Dr. Kissinger. And I was rather fulsome in my rhetoric. And then when the dinner was over, which was a very pleasant dinner, except for my feelings about some of the statements, I followed the cavalcade out to the guest house out at the Ayutang. And when we got there, we went for a walk in the garden, just the two of us. He starts out by saying that he couldn't understand why, if not I, somebody from the embassy should have come to greet him. And so I explained as carefully to him as I had done to Joe Kraft exactly what had happened. And then he said, well, your toast made up for it. I couldn't believe my ears. Then he began to tell me about his conversations. But anything that had any importance at all, he prefaced by saying, please don't report this, because I want to tell this to the president myself, or tell this to the secretary myself. And at the conclusion of our walk, all that I was left to report was that he had come and he had left. So I made no report at all.
And I believe he did not give a report upon his return.
Well, upon his return, he had breakfast with Holbrooke.
But I don't think he reported to Carter.
Not that I'm aware of. Not that I'm aware of. How much he reported to Holbrooke, I don't know. But I do know from Holbrooke that the first thing he took up with Holbrooke at that breakfast was, do you know what your ambassador did He did not come out to the airport to greet me, nor did anybody from the embassy. So apparently I had not mollified him as much as I had thought. And he left the next morning on Saturday the 28th. It was internally within China at a very early hour. And I didn't go to bid him goodbye either, not thinking much about it, very frankly. But later, when the next time I saw Huang Hua, he asked me, had I gone to say goodbye to Dr. Kissinger? So he had obviously discussed this at some length with the Chinese. And I said, no, I had not. Just made no explanation, just said, no, I had not.
But you know, I would have said, even with your very proper reasons for not going to see him, Secretary Kissinger was not helpful to the Carter administration on China policy. He did not endorse normalization at the time that it occurred.
No.
He, in fact, implied in cocktail parties, which Joe Kraft and others quickly picked up, that we had caved on points which he would have resisted, that he would have insisted on a Chinese pledge not to use force or some equivalent of that sort, and that he gave no indication of the negotiating record that he left us. It was really Winston Lord who months later, in testimony on Congress, said that he was confident that what we had agreed upon was what they would have agreed upon, and indeed that on the arms sales that we on balance probably did better than he expected us to have done.
Wasn't that testimony given in connection with the Taiwan Relations Act?
I don't remember when that testimony was given,
so
but I know Winston gave the testimony.
He made an excellent statement.
That's right.
And to be very frank about it, I think my not going to the airport or suggesting to my colleagues that no one should go, I took advantage of the Hong Kong telegram because I was very unhappy.
So that there was more to it than now you got to be honest in your memoirs later. The fact is the administration was not appreciative of Henry Kissinger at that time. Do you know what we had to do with Kissinger? Kissinger began to be a little bit more public. I sent a memo to Zbig, and Zbig called Kissinger in, or called him up, I'm not sure. And I think he would have done it without my recommendation, but I sent a note saying, look at what this man is doing, and here is the record, and here are the things that he told the Chinese, and you call him up and tell him that we have been faithful to the negotiating record and have not leaked any of his stuff, and we would appreciate him being faithful to his own negotiating record.
There was one other thing he said in this walk around the garden. He said, I came here thinking it was Brzezinski who accomplished normalization. The Chinese say that is not true. The Chinese say it was you. Obvious reasons, I made no comment about that. We just continued to walk along, he said. I find that quite interesting, he said. Nothing more than that.
Well, you cannot. It's possible the Chinese said that, but you cannot believe that man at all.
No.
For anything that he says, anyone else says. Just extraordinary. One other thing about that evening that I'd like to ask you. What was the chemistry between Kissinger and Deng Xiaoping on that particular occasion?
It was a warm, cordial evening. I think there were only two tables. It was in one of the smaller rooms in the Great Hall. Deng was very relaxed. But when Kissinger was, first of all, he was addressing me across Deng about the inanities of the American bureaucracy. Deng would just, when it was translated for him, of course, he would just laugh a little bit but make no comment. And I had the sense, founded on what, I don't know, but I had the sense that he was not quite approving of this either.
Because you will recall that in the Kissinger-Deng exchanges of 74 and 75, the rapport between the two was not equal to the rapport that had been established between Kissinger and Zhou Enlai.
No, that's quite obvious.
Kissinger, in fact, on one of his trips, began to talk about Deng to some of his correspondents that then leaked out. Was derogatory, essentially, of
derogatory
Deng Xiaoping.
In a personal sense.
In a personal sense, derogatory. Very surprising. One of the few times that as Secretary of State, he really, I thought, was guilty of indiscretions. And I wondered whether that was at all manifest.
Not at that dinner. Deng, as I say, was very relaxed, very cordial. And, of course, except for TRA, the development of the relationship was going smoothly, and he was very happy with it. But it was really extraordinary. This brilliant man, and he is a brilliant man, having such a great sense of insecurity.
Well, petty. He's a very petty, petulant.
He must be extremely, extremely difficult to work with.
On a couple of the plane trips out, was in the company of those who had been with Kissinger as well. Bill Gleistein had been on a Kissinger trip to China. Someone else had been on a Kissinger trip to China. And they contrasted both Vance and Brzezinski's trips, but because Kissinger was just worked himself up into inordinate states of shouting and running up and down the plane, carrying on, demanding things that had just been given out, just total force of energy.
Really is quite extraordinary. Then, as I say, he left that morning, and I haven't seen him since. Bob Goheen, our ambassador to India, came very briefly as our house guest. He was on his way back to the United States by arrangement. Never been in China and wanted to see something of it. Saw very little, actually. He was there. With us only 3 days, I think, and gave another bilateral farewell dinner for the Japanese ambassador and Mrs. Sato, where there were just Americans and the Japanese present. And as I have said on more than one occasion, he and I had developed a very close relationship. That kind of relationship was not continued with his successor, who Sato had been a high-ranking person of the Foreign Office, and I think we have on the record that he had told me that he did not expect to stay long. His primary purpose was to complete the normalization of relations between Japan and China, and that accomplished, he would not be staying long. Well, he stayed about 8 months, actually, after the Peace and Friendship Treaty was concluded in August. And his successor was quite a different kind of individual. And there was no opportunity, really, to develop the same kind of relationship, because each of us were, to some degree, going our separate ways, developing trade relationships and other such things. Then I noticed that National Defense University Group.
Bob Gard.
Right, right. That was it, yes.
That was the one of our first military exchanges that we began to have, actually.
That's
also
right.
Took a bit of maneuvering to get that visit off the ground.
And at that time, I then went back to the United States, primary purpose being to speak at the annual dinner of the Asia Society. This was the only time that I was requested to submit my text in advance. And I think the motivator was Harry Thayer. And I wrote out, I finished writing out the speech at home in Rochester, Michigan at that time.
What was the concern that you might, were there some issues?
Well, there was a new relationship, and this was to a big, prestigious audience. It turned out there were some 1,500, mostly top-ranking business executives. And I finished working on it at home in Rochester, Michigan on Sunday, May 6th, and on Monday, May 7th, and then had it typed out and sent it into the department. There was one paragraph. I haven't got it here, but I'll have to look it up and put it into the record, which I had inserted, which I've said many times since, that left to themselves, there'd be a developing economic relationship on which they can build a political accommodation, which can take into account the positions outlined by the Chinese, primarily by Deng Xiaoping, keeping their own political and social systems and even their own armed forces under a special autonomy. Harry fought like a tiger to have that either taken out or diluted. This would be offensive to Taiwan. Dick was for leaving it in, but it was inconclusive. So I did not say it at the dinner. Dick then called me. Oh, he was there at the dinner. He wanted to know why I hadn't spoken this paragraph. I said, well, what if I take this business of review seriously? And he said, well, you should have. I expect you to, although he hadn't said that. And so in the text as issued, it was finally included. But that was my only experience of during that week. I also had lunch with the New York Times editorial board. Von Sulzberger was there, whom I knew earlier times, who had been with the AP executive board in China. It was the only time I ever met Bill Sapphire. They had brought him in specially. Of course, he was not a friendly luncheon companion on the question of China. He really went after me on the question, but I think it came out all right.
Did you come down to Washington on this day? I don't remember your or maybe this was the first time I saw you since normalization. It's also possible. I don't remember.
No, I went directly from Detroit to New York. And then I went up to Boston to see my daughter. I went up, Sharon had never seen our place at Black Lake. In northern Michigan, we came back to Michigan and went up there. Yes, I finally went to Washington.
I remember trying to call you then in Michigan. Maybe.
Right, I went to Washington then on the 22nd of May, the Asian Society dinner having been on the 9th of May. Meeting with Harry Thayer, Dick Holbrook, Herb Hansel. Went out to Langley and met with Frank Carlucci and Stan Turner.
That's the time. That's the time.
When I was prodded by...
Yes.
That
is correct.
By Dick to find out...
That is correct.
If anything were being done on listening posts in China.
That is correct.
Because...
Now the path began to be fired.
Stan Turner had said to me, voluntarily, I didn't ask for it, we will do nothing in China of which you don't have knowledge. He said, that's my word. And when I raised this question in a circuitous way, they said nothing that they were aware of. I spent half an hour with them. In fact, the conversation got into the advantages and disadvantages and congressional reactions and so on, if that were to be done. Then on that same day that I went to Langley in the morning, I spent 45 minutes with the vice president, and after that, saw you. He knew then, of course, that he was going to China, right? Of course.
We had begun to... yes, it, dates had not yet been set. No, I'm sorry. No, because it was being considered, but there was a question of...
Political.
You saw him political matters, because...
He wanted me to... it was Kennedy. Kennedy was already... there were great pressures on Kennedy at that time to become a candidate, although he had not become a candidate. And Fritz Mondale considered that Doug Fraser was a key, and that he could be the bridge. That was what the conversation was primarily about. And I felt the same way. But, Doug could play a role in Kennedy and Carter and the immediate people into a more harmonious relationship. At that point, the administration politically was, I think, ready to try to do something.
I see. I believe this was the first time that I saw you since normalization. No, because you had been earlier in March. That's not right. That's wrong. When your testimony. But what we were thinking about at this point was not Mondale's trip, but when was President Carter going to China? He had not yet given up the possibility of going himself, and we were really thinking in terms of sequences, and the Mondale trip was a possibility, but the president still, as I recall, not fully committed to it. I believe that that only occurred in over the summer, that it became clear that that would be the sequence, would be Mondale going in the fall. And then you will remember we had a long discussion of dates of the Mondale trip, where August was not necessarily the first choice, and we thought of an October trip, and then finally it settled into to August.
Right. And then we went back to China on the 25th of May, and went back on with Bob Strauss and his delegation.
You were with him.
On the government plane. And we went through Japan, and the CCPIT gave a welcoming banquet for the delegation. We had a reception for the delegation at the embassy. Bob met with Wang Guo separately. Han Xu gave a luncheon at the Sick Duck restaurant for Dick Holbrooke, and then there was a dinner by the foreign trade minister Li Qiang for the Strauss delegation. They also met with Deng Xiaoping. Not because of the textile business, I think, but because the Chinese understood Strauss was very close to Carter. And then that night on the 30th of May, on Wednesday the 30th of May, Strauss gave the farewell banquet in the Great Hall. Chinese host from CCPIT was Wang Yaoting.
Right.
And that was quite an event. Bob brought in, as the host, bottles of bourbon and Puerto Rican rum. When I told him the Chinese that we did not see eye to eye on Puerto Rico, that the rum got sort of shoved in the center of the table. But we were drinking bourbon. The Chinese presented those small wine glasses for the bourbon rather than the smaller Maotai glasses. But there was still Maotai on the table. Textile negotiations hadn't gotten anywhere. Madam, what was her name?
Oh, I don't remember. She was tough.
Madam Han. She was very tough. And she was hanging tough. And I don't know whether it was inspired by the bourbon or the Maotai or the combination. but up at table number one, we thought it would be a good idea if after dinner the negotiators went back and had one last try in the hope that when the delegation left that there could be the meeting of the minds. And of course, the Chinese already knew at this stage that we would take unilateral action on, I think it was five categories in the event of lack of agreement. Madame Han was very upset when she was informed that this was expected. Our side, I don't think, was any happier, but they were not as obviously unhappy. And they did go back after the dinner. I guess tried till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, but nothing really changed.
This was the famous banquet of the Bob Strauss toast to Wang Yao-ting. Toward the end, they had been drinking and drinking. Wang Yao-ting is known among the Chinese as a
champion
drinker, and the Chinese phrase of it is a peg leg, right? The liquor just falls in his leg. And Bob Strauss finally got up, according to Dick Holbrook, told me the story, and proposed a toast to this son of a bitch, Wang Yao-ting, who was trying to drink him under the table. And only Bob Strauss could get away with something like that. Translator, not fazed at all, translated into it and used the Chinese equivalent, didn't literally translate son of a bitch, called him a turtle's egg. Someone who doesn't know his own father.
Yeah, that's true. I think it was Ji Zhaoju who was there who supplied that rather than the normal translator, who just looked nonplussed. And Ji Zhaoju supplied the translation, but laughing. It didn't bother Wang Yao-ting. Then there was a dinner hosted by Huan Xiang, the vice president of the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences at the Minzu restaurant. Would that have been after they had come back from the meeting at in Virginia?
No, that was the winter of 1980, 79-80. Huan Xiang made an earlier trip. Maybe that was his first trip.
Maybe this was just... I think this was more just a get acquainted dinner. What is your estimate as to where he stands in the scheme of things politically? He certainly is very freely spoken. He was the one who, in a subsequent time, sitting in the residence with many Chinese in earshot, saying to me that Mao Zedong was no Marxist. Oh, he quoted Marx, but he never read Marx.
Mm-hmm.
Very emphatic about it.
I think that he's a very important fellow.
Seems to be.
I think that he's a sophisticated man with a appreciation of world affairs. His stint in the EEC acquainted him with Europe. I don't think of him as dogmatic at all, and I felt at times that he could be a rather exposed individual.
He can hang tough, though, on the Sino-American relationship.
Well, I think he's a nationalistic, as all of those fellows are, on the Taiwan issue in particular.
Right.
But in terms of the reforms that he is prepared to envision within China, I think he's prepared to go very far.
Yeah, I think that's true.
I think he is one who, at this time anyway, in spring of 79, was probably of a mood to say that China had been misgoverned for 20 years.
Well, I always found it very interesting to meet with him because he did give insights that were not otherwise available, and you wouldn't just get the canned language that was appropriate to the time. I think, too, the fact that he was more insistent on our recognition of their problems, because he was willing to talk to us more freely about the difficulties that they had. I think what prompted him was that we were becoming much too complacent about the Taiwan question. I think his estimate was that we felt, well, that's settled, that's that, nothing more needs to be done.
Now, do you recall whether he was raising this issue as early as late May 79,
no.
that came up the
no.
first time, or early 80?
I think of later.
Yeah.
Later
session. Yeah.
Because I saw him many times.
When did that begin to start creeping into his discussions, do you recall?
What was that gathering he went to? Where was it? What am I thinking about?
Williamsburg.
My memory says after he came back from that, because I'd had such glowing reports of the contribution he had made there, and his openness of his mind. But when we met with him in Peking, he was, but he was also much sharper. Surprised me by the sharpness of his comment about where the American-Chinese relationship was going.
That's interesting. I'm sorry, I misspoke. The Williamsburg Conference was January 1981, not 80, 81.
But there must have been some other event that he was involved in, because
he had come to the United States earlier, but January 81 was
Williamsburg. There was one session, maybe it wasn't Williamsburg, probably wasn't Williamsburg, but he was involved in, where they had many long off-the-record sessions in the lounge of this place. And Doak Barnett, I remember, was there. I think I heard about it first from him.
Well, that
was much earlier than
okay.
It was quite a while before I left.
That's an interesting point to try and trace down. No, I might. That's right.
Then I know that on the 1st of June there was a dinner hosted by Mrs. Vincent Astor. She was in China in connection with the making of the Suzhou Garden, which is now, of course, in the Metropolitan Museum, and which she had had commissioned, and which must have cost a very great deal of money. The Chinese were extremely cooperative in that. Have you seen it? I haven't seen it.
No, I haven't.
Last time I was in the Metropolitan with Sharon, we asked could it be seen, and they said no. Later on, when the director heard I was there and had asked, he was very upset that I had not made known who I was, because obviously I could have seen what was there, but I have not yet seen it. And all through that, the Governor Dalton group, the Vice Premier Ujo Lee, Governor Dalton, Virginia?
Virginia.
Right. The first of came.
You just have a whole...